Blog Talk Radio.
Never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say, never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say, I'm stronger, I'm wiser, I'm better, much better. When I look back over all you brought me through, I can see that you were the one I held on to. And I never,
never would have made it.
Oh, I never could have made it.
Somebody just needs to testify to somebody next to him. Tell him, I'm stronger, I'm wiser, I'm better, much better. When I look back over what he brought me through, I realize I made it because I had you to hold on to. Now I'm stronger. Now I'm wiser, I'm better, so much better. I made it. Is there anybody in this house other than me that could declare you made it? Tell your neighbor, never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Tell them, never could have made it. Oh, I wish I had some help here. I wish I had just two or three people that would just declare it. Never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Never could have made it.
Never could have made it.
I just love to encourage myself. Sometimes I just look in the mirror and say, I'm strong, I'm wise, I am better, so much better. When I look back over what he brought me through, I realize I made it because I had you to hold on to. But I never I never could have made it without you. Yeah, 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 Lord. Oh, good God Almighty, never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Never could have made it. Sing it one more time. All I need is just one more time. Everybody say it with me.
Never would have made it.
Oh.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Friday night's edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you so much for taking the time out each week to come and join us right here, Center Stage. And tonight, you will not be disappointed. We have an excellent show lined up for you. We're going to be talking to survivors of the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys about what they experienced while they were there. We're calling them survivors tonight because there were many young boys that did not survive their experience there. So if you are not aware of this story, it's developing on the web almost hourly. I think as of the last I read about it, 55 bodies have been discovered on the grounds of the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys. So that's why we're calling the guests we have tonight survivors. But before we begin, we want to acknowledge the fact that we did reach out to Senator Bill Nelson's office, and we asked him to come on tonight. We wanted him to give us an update on what's going on with the excavation there at Dozier, but we were told by a member of his staff today that he is traveling, and they were not able to reach him, and we then asked for a statement of some type, but we did not receive one prior to airtime. But if you have not been up to speed on this particular story, let me just give you a little background. The Florida School of Boys, also known as the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys, was a reform school operated by the state of Florida in the panhandle town of Marianna from January of 1900 to June of 2011. For a time, it was the largest juvenile reform institution in the United States. A second campus was opened in the town of Okeechobee in 1955. Throughout its 111-year history, the school gained a reputation for abuse, beatings, rapes, tortures, and even murder of students by staff. Despite periodic investigations, changes in leadership, and promises to improve, the allegations of cruelty and abuse continued. Many of the allegations were confirmed by separate investigations by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement in 2010 and the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice in 2011. state authorities closed the school permanently in June of 2011. So that pretty much brings you up to speed if you have not been following the story, but our guest will take it from there tonight. But before we begin, I want to bring my co-host up. Good evening, Christopher. Good evening, AJ. How are you?
Most excellent. How y'all doing today? Y'all doing all right?
We're doing good. We're doing good. We got a great show tonight.
Good evening, AJ.
We got a great show tonight, and we have a lot of very, very interesting guests. I was very pleased to speak with each and every one of them, and they have the most incredible stories. I found them to be people that, even though some of the most horrific things, they live to tell their story, and I really count them as survivors, as I said in the intro. So are y'all ready? Because we got a lot of ground to cover.
We're ready.
AJ, y'all ready?
Ready to go.
Yeah. Y'all ready? Okay. Well, tonight, y'all, we got, you know, we started out, Antoinette Harold brought me this this show. Antoinette is a Blog Talk host as well as an author, and she originally contacted me about this story, and she was going to come on with her and Pastor Gaddy, and we were not able to get to the story immediately because we had already booked several shows ahead. But when we did get a chance to get to it was tonight, and since we first talked about it, the story has continued to develop. So because of that, not only are we bringing on Antoinette Harold tonight and Johnny Gaddy, we're also bringing Mr. Roger Dean Kaiser, Andrew Puhl, and Chaplain Johnny Marks on as our guests. All of the males that I mentioned are survivors of the Dozier Reform School. So tonight we're going to open up their phone lines, and I see numbers on the board. The boards are jammed, y'all, and I'm going to try to find the numbers that I recognize, and the others I'm going to assume are callers who want to talk about this as well. I see Pastor or Chaplain Johnny Marks, and I'm going to open his phone line. Mr. Puhl is with us, and I'm going to open his phone line. And Johnny Gaddy, I saw him on the board a minute ago. We're going to open Pastor Gaddy's line, and I saw Antoinette on the line as well. I'm going to try to go to her. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Did I get everybody? Did I miss anybody? I don't think I did. Well, we're going to start with Antoinette and Pastor Johnny Gaddy. Good evening to both of you.
Hi, Carrie, and thank you for having both of us and everyone on the show tonight. Thank you and all your co-hosts.
Thank you. Pastor Gaddy, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, good evening.
Good evening.
I first got a chance to speak to Pastor Gaddy, and I must admit he's the most charming man. But when listening to his story, he doesn't sound like what he's been through. And Pastor Gaddy, I mean that. I found you to be so charming. You know, a lot of times I would think someone who had been through your experience would be very angry and bitter, but you seem just the opposite.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Believe me, I am just the opposite.
Well, thank God. Thank God. You do not sound and you're not like what you've been through. Tell us, you went to the Arthur G. Dozier, a school for boys, from what period of time to what period of time?
From 57 to 62.
And you went there for what?
Not going to school.
Okay, so they kept you there for 5 years.
They call it truancy.
Wow. And so you go there for truancy. What happens when someone goes to a place like that for truancy? What happened when you first hit the grounds of that facility? Did you know you were in trouble when you first got there?
Well, I know that I was in trouble when I left my mother. to go to a place I had never been. Right then I knew I was in trouble.
I understand that that your mother, your father was not with the family, or was he deceased? Is that what your situation
was? Deceased.
Your father was deceased and your mother was on welfare. Is that what the case was?
Right. And they said I was a ward of the state.
Exactly. So because of that, they made you a ward of the state and sent you away to this school for 5 years just for truancy.
Right.
Okay. And tell us about your experience there.
Well, they put me on first they give us our uniform, and they put me on a farm crew, which we had even an odd day. One day I went to school, the next day I went to work. Mm-hmm. And we got up by a bugle in the morning, and they put me, they signed me to a farm crew that we was planting in the fields. And after about 6 or 7 months, I was learned to drive a tractor, so they put me on a tractor crew. So I went around different areas of the college picking up the trash and taking the food out of the cafeteria to the hog pen.
And so they put you to work. I mean, how old were you when you went there?
11.
Okay, so you're 11 years old, and you go there, and basically it sounds like you're doing work like a grown man.
It was a work as a grown man, but I started out in going down in the swamp, tying chains to stumps. Then we had a saw that had two handles on it that after we pulled a tree down, we had to cut them up.
Okay.
So we were doing the work of a grown man.
Of a grown man. And so at some point during the time there, you got a chance to move from one job to another job. I understand basically you did whatever needed to be done. Is that correct?
Right, whatever I was told to do. I stayed on the same crew, but mm-hmm. I just moved up to the tractor instead of just working the fields.
Okay.
When I got my, one of the guys told me let's bust the tires. We didn't have to work that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't bust the tires with him. And he went and told the crew instructor that I bust the tires. So because I didn't tell him, I had to ride to the White House. That was my first experience of being so bad.
Tell us what the White House is.
Well, at the time, it was a yellow building with a single bed in it. It's a little room where you had to wait in, a little small room that we had to wait in, one room where we had to go in and lay on a bed. And they had like a single bed, and we had to grip the railing of the bed. And it had a notch on the wall, and we had to look at the notch on the wall. And he didn't want us to turn around to look at him. If we turned to look, he said he can hit us between our leg and kill us.
Mm.
So he said if you turn to loose that bed, he wasn't going to stop beating you. He wasn't going to count the licks that wherever he was at in the beating, and he was going to continue to on the beat you when he hit me. And I had never experienced a lick like that in my life, and I turned loose the bed, and he hit me upside my head and said, "You don't get back down on that bed, I'll kill you."
Wow.
So I don't know what to do, but I know I had to get back on that bed, and I know I had to hold that bed. If I didn't, this guy was going to kill me.
Mm.
So he had me bloodied pretty good. And he was making joke about it, you know, how many licks that he had gave me. And I'm scared to death. I called for anybody I could call, mama, God, anybody. Nobody came, though. So I had to endure the spanking. And when I got through getting the spanking, I had to go to the cafeteria And I asked him, could I go by the cottage and change? He said, no, I want the boys to see how bloody I made you. And that'll teach them not to come to the White House. So it was pretty rough going for the first time.
Let's be clear on that term, spanking. The school referred to it as a spanking, but from the way it sounds, it was everything but a spanking.
I don't know where they come up with that, but my mama had the impression, you know, just a few little old taps, and that was it. She didn't have no idea my body was torn half in two from them licks that I was getting. And I had the caterpillars to sit on when I got from the White House to the cafeteria for about a couple of days at least.
And so that was your first experience with the White House. And so,
yes.
So pretty much, after, I'm sure that is still fear in you. But after that, as you worked around the field, did you see different things that instilled even more fear in you?
Well, I saw body parts in the pits. I saw hands, a body boy hands in the pit. And I
explain
told
the
boy, it's a pit where I used to take the trash at, and after I take the trash and dump it out the cans, because I had a, back in the 50s, we had a trailer that I used to put the cans on a trailer and take it to the pit and throw it over, and the boy take a tract and push it over in the hole. And that's when I saw the boy hand, and I told him, man, that's a boy hand. That's when he made the statement, Johnny, don't ever say that again. Pretend like you didn't even see that, because that could be your hand. And I saw human remain when I took the slop. The boy was stirring, and they cook all the food up there for the hogs. And I saw a foot in the hog pen. And I said, man, they need boys up here. He said, Johnny, you want to leave here alive, don't ever say that again. So I learned to keep my mouth shut. And I told my family when I came back, but I didn't ever repeat what I had seen for over 50-some years.
So you didn't even feel comfortable telling your family 5 years later when you got home?
I told my family, but they didn't believe me. They thought that place wasn't that bad. Nobody really took us serious because we was bad boys. We had been to the boys that was in Mariana, we called it the formatory school, and they labeled us as bad boys, and they didn't want our children playing with us. And it's kind of hard when your family didn't believe what you was telling them.
I understand that there were boys there as young as 6 that you knew of, 6 and 7 years old.
Yes, ma'am. They was in Robinson. Robinson College was the smallest college back there.
Wow.
And
this is just an incredible.
In the winter months when it got cold, and I used to try to help them out, you know, because when you get cold and you go to the fire and the heat up too fast, it just burn you. Look like you burn all the way through, and you just look at these kids crying. And I used to tell them, don't go right up on the fire, kind of stand back.
Mm-hmm.
And I got write-ups for that, you know, telling the kids not to get too close to that fire because it hurts them pretty bad. It's very painful.
And I understand that you even experienced some sexual abuse or molested while you were there as well. Is that true?
Yes, ma'am, by the teacher. And the cottage father, he's aware of it. They know everything that went on them places. They know them were some cruel peoples.
And I understand you were there for 5 years and you never got one visit from family while you were there.
None whatsoever.
That must have been tough. That must have been tough. And Antoinette, I understand that you got with Pastor Gaddy and some of the others and wrote a book about what they went through called The Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rape, Murder, Beatings, and Slavery.
Yes, it was time for them to tell their story in the form of a book and documentaries to pretty much educate the world and other people on what they went through. My involvement with that came as reaching out to Roger Dean Kaiser one afternoon because of my research in the study of Penage, which I was very clear of people being held in turpentine camps and convict leases. But it wasn't until I met Roger that I was very clear that there was some types of Penage and slavery taking place at this school. And so that's how I got involved and met everyone.
Oh, well, speaking of Mr. Roger Dean Kaiser, Mr. Kaiser, how are you this evening? Do I have Mr. Kaiser's phone line open? Let me make sure that I have Mr. Kaiser's phone line open. Give me 1 second. Mr. Kaiser is on the phone and is one of our guests this evening, and I, for some reason, did not open his line. Good evening, Mr. Kaiser. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thank you.
Good. Listen, I understand that you researched this thing, or not researched this thing, you lived it, but you tried to get someone's attention to tell your story for over 25 years. Is that true?
Yes. Of course, when I first got out of the school, I didn't say anything because I was a ward of the court, and, of course, I had been threatened up there. You ever say anything about what's going on up here, you know, you won't see the light of day, basically, is what they meant. And so I didn't say anything to anybody. Then as I got older and got out from under the juvenile court of Duval County, then I started contacting governors all the way from Governor Askew all the way down the line. And, of course, I never heard anything until I finally got hold of Governor Bush and Ted Bush. And then he wrote me a letter back and apologized, but he really didn't do anything about it. So then I started working on a book. I started a website, which was started off the American Orphan, which was on like Yahoo GeoCities when they first started with the Internet. And I started putting the stories on there, and then I wrote the story, The Heart of the White House. And one evening after I started the website, I got a call from Edward Asner, the actor. And he wanted to know if I would ever wanted to publish any of my work. And I thought, well, I only had a sixth-grade education. He'd really want to read what I write. And he contacted a publisher, and then 2 weeks later I was under a contract for 2 or 3 books. And then I just continued writing, and then I sat down and started writing the book, The White House Boys, an American Tragedy, which finally broke the story. And the press picked that up. Then it started to move along, and then I met several of the guys. And I didn't know any of the guys that are involved now. I didn't know any of them at when I was at the school. I was from an orphanage, so I didn't know anybody outside or really inside. And I guess what finally broke the story, of course, nobody would believe it because nobody would believe that something as bad as a concentration camp actually existed in the United States of America. But then
tell us a little bit about what happened to you while you were there.
Well, basically, I guess I wasn't there a week, and I thought it was, when I first drove in, you know, I'd been raised in an orphanage my entire childhood, and which was pretty rough, the Children's Home Society in Jacksonville, Florida, and of course, when I drove in, heard I was going to the reform school, that worried me a little bit, but I didn't really know what it was, because we were totally locked away in the orphanage from society, so I hadn't heard the things about Mariana. But when we drove in, I saw this beautiful place, looked like a college campus. I saw this football field, and I saw a swimming pool and a gymnasium, and I thought, this is just going to be wonderful. And one of the things that I wrote is, you know, little did I know that there was a monster hiding behind every blade of grass because it looked like a college campus. And, of course, I was assigned to Dr. Robert Curry, and almost from the very first week I was there, I use the term he molested me. He never actually touched me, but what he would do was he would sit there and he would make me drop my pants and he would try to make me masturbate while he sat there at his desk smoking his pipe. And then when he sat there and he would finally jump up and say, get out of here, you little perverted bastard, and chase me off. And this went on for quite some time. I couldn't even count the times that he called me to his office. Then finally, when he saw that I was not going to go along with his program, then sort of hell came down on me. They called me to the office one day, and said I was going to the White House. Of course, I was shaking, you know, like heck. I think I was 12 or 13 at the time. And I really didn't know that I had done anything. They took me over to the White House with about three or four of the boys, and when we were going into the building, I was shaking, and I tripped over the step on the, we used to go in the side door. We never went in the front door. That was always locked. And I tripped, and when I did, the guy grabbed me by the shirt and hit me in the back of the head, and my nose hit the floor. Blood went all over the place. And we went in, and I was the first one in the room. And when they put me down on the bed, told me to turn my head to the right. I felt something slide out from under the pillow. And when I turned my head, there was this leather strap. Basically, I don't remember what it looked like because I was just almost in a state of shock.
Turn you sound just a little muffled. Let me stop you for a second. You sound just a little muffled. Is there any way we can?
Oh, okay. Is that a little better?
That's better. Okay.
Okay, and when that strap came down on me, what it did is I worked on a cattle ranch for a while when I was a young boy, and we used to brand cattle. And when that strap hit me, I could smell that burning that I smelled when we were branding those calves. And I come off that bed, and I mean, I bounced from the head, pillowed, clean down to the end, was trying to climb up the wall, and they were just beating the holy hell out of me. When they got done, well, they finally got me back on the bed and did whatever it is they did. I don't even remember what happened after that. The next thing I know, I'm walking into Dr. Curry's office, and or to the Dr. Curry's building there, which was the guidance center. And when I walked in, the secretary says, who are you? And I said, I'm Roger Kaiser. Well, she knew me well. I was in there every week or so. She says, oh, my God. The next thing you know, they take me over to Mr. Hatton's office, told me to sit down. Of course, I couldn't sit down because I was just really hurting. I could barely walk. And so in order not to sit down, I said, well, I have to use the bathroom. And I knew I was about to cry, and I didn't want the other boys to see me cry, so I wanted to get to the bathroom and wash my face. And he said, there's the bathroom. Make it quick. And I don't know, for some reason I got real brave. I sort of stuck my finger in my mouth, and I said, one of these days I'm going to come back here and tell what you people are doing here. And he says, hey, buddy. And I turned around, and he says, let me tell you something, mister. That's a good way to wake up dead tomorrow morning, sonny boy. And so I went.
Now, listen, y'all. I'm going to stop it right there. He said at 12 he made a vow that one day he was going to come back and do what, Mr. Kaiser?
And tell what they were doing around here.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish.
Yeah, and I went into the bathroom, and when I saw my bloody self in the mirror, it was like a monster. I almost just screamed and started crying, but I put my hands over my mouth because I didn't want the other boys to hear me crying. Then I tried to go to the bathroom. I couldn't pee, so I tried to pull my pants down. My underwear, I got my pants down, but the underwear wouldn't come down because the underwear had been beaten into my buttocks. And I finally went back out. I washed my face a little bit. My shirt was actually torn completely off me. It was hanging in my waistband. And I walked back out, and there was Mr. Seelander, my college father. And he took me back to the college first, and he called and started complaining about the way I looked and what they had done. Then he took me over to the hospital, and they soaked me in a bathtub full of Epsom salt for about a half hour or so. And then took me into the examination room and removed my underwear from my buttocks with tweezers and that type thing. And I actually went to the White House five times, but I was only beaten twice. The other time was just for Mr. Curry to scare me and to keep doing what he wanted me to do.
You called the White House torture chamber.
Yes. Well, that's what it was to me. It was a torture chamber. And, I mean, if you knew the smell inside there, when you went in there, it would almost gag you. It was like going into a dungeon in some fort, you know, some early Spanish fort or something. It would just gag you. And then they had this big industrial fan they would turn on. Now, I know the fan was there because they turned it on when they beat us, but I don't even know where it was or how they turned it on. I never saw that. But
now, how long were you there?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
How long were you there?
I went there the first time on June the 3rd, 1959. I got out on March 21st, 1960. I went back on October the 4th, 1960, and I was released on November 21st, 1961.
Wow. So you actually made two visits there.
Yes.
When you were there, did you see other boys being beaten? Did you see boys coming up missing? Did you experience all that while you were there?
Oh, yeah. I saw many things while I was there. I actually was in the dormitory one night. They would come in and actually take boys out of the dormitory at night. I remember seeing one time, and I don't remember who it was, or I don't remember the boy or the employee or cottage father, whoever it was. I know it wasn't Mr. Sealander, who was having the boy perform oral sex on him in the shower room. They came in one night, and I was in the bed, and what kind of language do you want me to use? Do you want me to say what they said, or?
You say what they said.
Clean it up.
Say what they said.
They come walking in, they have some flashlights, and I sort of close my eyes. The next thing you know, somebody grabs hold of me, and he pulls me up in the bed, and he says, "Well, I bet this little bastard can suck a dick. Get up." And so they pull me up, and I was just ready to freak out. They got one other boy, too, but I never saw him come outside. And they took me out, and I was looking for Mr. Sealander, and they took me out. Robert Curry was there standing by his car with a couple other guys. I don't remember who they were, other employees. And when I was in the orphanage, when Mr. Ball would try to molest us, I was known as the kicker. I would fall down on the bed, and I'd start kicking until they finally would leave me alone. Well, I fell down on the clay court and started kicking whoever it was that had hold of me, and Mr. Sealander come running out. "What are you doing? What are you doing here? Leave that boy alone." And Mr. Sealander was screaming that he'd call the police, you know, and he took me, got them to leave me alone, took me in, put me in the shower, and I remember laying down in the bottom of the shower, and I evidently fell asleep. When I woke up the next morning, I was back in bed. But from what I gather, they were going to take me to the rape room, wherever that was. I'm not sure exactly where it was. I think it was down in the basement of the guidance center. I'm not sure. But, yeah, there was boys that came up missing. I'm not even going to go into the one about the boy I saw at the laundry. I won't even go into that because there's some controversy over that, even though I wrote the story long before anybody else said it. But basically, I guess what I would like to say is, even though I worked on this for years and we couldn't get anybody to believe us, what finally really broke the thing wide open wasn't just my book. Everybody expected a lot of these guys that were in the school to be little Charlie Mansons, little, you know, guys coming out of prison who, you know, did this or did that. But as the other guys started coming forward, and here we ended up with a couple of authors came forward, a decorated military guy. Jerry was a country singer. So we had all these guys who had some credibility, and this really helped us to get somebody to listen to us. And I think without all these guys working together and doing that, I think we'd still be fighting a losing battle today.
Wow. It's so, you know, your story is so incredible. I mean, and I think the thing that I walk away with is that 25 years of trying to get someone to listen to you, trying to get someone to believe in you, what was it like to keep going? I mean, or where did you find the strength to keep going when you hit so many brick walls?
Well, I've been asked that many times, and the only explanation I can give is this. As I said earlier, I was raised in the Children's Home Society orphanage from the age of 3 or 4. So by the time I got to Marianna, I was already institutionalized. I was already used to being molested. I was already used to being cursed and called every name in the book and beaten and kicked and slapped and everything else. So by the time I got to Marianna, that was a normal life for me. I don't think I've ever shed a tear, except maybe one night with one of the black guys at the motel when we started talking, and he just wailed when we started talking about the beatings. I think I almost cried that time. I did have tears in my eyes. But other than that, I've never cried because that was the life I was used to. So I don't think it was as bad for me going from hell to hell compared to a guy who had a family who went from home, say a church, to hell. So I think I was able to take it a lot better. And the other thing is this. a lot of guys say, well, you know, you got into trouble and you got out of that and you never got into trouble again. Why is that? Well, a lot of the guys that came out of there, myself included, were really full of hatred. I mean, they just beat you so bad, treated you so badly, and you know, here you are, a teenage boy, trying to become a man, trying to act as though you can take care of yourself, and these people are just degrading you as much as they possibly can. You're living in total fear every day, and so when they walked out, they couldn't do anything right then to get even, so when they got out, they started getting even with society for what happened to them. Well, I did the same thing. It's just that I figured out a legal way to do it. I managed to take my frustration and my hatred out by using their own legal system against them. So I finally, even though I'd only gone to the sixth grade, I went to work for the Tulsa World and Tribune newspaper. I was a district manager there. And then I went to work for the Stanislaus County Welfare Rights Organization, representing women who were on welfare. And I started learning, wait a minute, I can punish these people for what they did to me and what they did to the other boys by using their own system against them. Every time they even fart, I will go to the newspaper. I will file petitions. I'll do whatever it is that I can do. And so
that's you found a way to turn it around. And I think, and I've quoted you several times this week, as Mr. Kaiser says something I'll take to my grave, he said that he considers the survivors of the Dozier School, you call them dead boys who live to tell the story.
Yes, and that's something I think that never needs to be forgotten. I understand that all these boys that were killed, that's a very important issue and that should be taken care of. But I don't want the men who were beaten, molested, raped, and just even the ones that were just lived in total fear day and night for months and years in some cases to be forgotten, because we are the dead boys who survived, who came back to tell the story. So if there's an apology due, you certainly can't apologize to the dead boys, but you can't apologize to us. And I think Florida needs to make that right.
I agree. If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, did the state of Florida allow rape, torture, and murder at Dozier Reform School? We're talking with author Antoinette Harrell, survivors Shani Lee Gaddy, Roger Dean Kaiser, Andrew Puhl, and Johnny Marks. If you have a question or a comment, get on the phone line. Call us up at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. And by the way, I see quite a few people holding, and I'm going to get to you in just a second. Again, if you are someone who was a victim and survived the Arthur G. Dozier Reform School for Boys, get on the phone lines. Call us up tonight and hopefully we'll be able to get to you and you can tell us your story. But next we're going to go to Mr. Andrew Puhl. How are you tonight, Mr. Puhl?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
Great. You know, I talked with you, and your story is similar to Mr. Kaiser's story. You basically had been in foster care, was it foster care or reform school pretty much, or I'm sorry, I'm getting it wrong. You were pretty much an orphanage your whole life as well, correct?
No. I came from
the good home.
A good home, stable family. My parents actually had some political connections, and I know for a fact that the superintendent, Lennox Williams, mentioned me in a newspaper article when I was sent there. So I think I had kind of special treatment. Matter of fact, I would have to say, compared to Johnny Gaddy and Roger Kaiser and many others, my experience is probably almost like a picnic. You know, they would have probably envied having my stay at the school, you know.
So you were there from when?
Pardon me?
You were there from what period to what period?
I was there from October the 12th, 1966, to February the 28th, 1967. So I was only there 4.5 months, which is almost a record of getting out of there.
Uh-huh. Wow. So So, wow. And so, this is the best story I heard so far. So there were people
It's not as dramatic as the other guys, I tell you.
So you actually got a chance to not have the long stays that some had, but did you see the same things that they saw? Did you see torture of other boys and molestation of other boys and cruelty toward the other boys, verbally and physically?
Yes, the second day I was there, I was getting my physical, and you have to get undressed, and a doctor there would check you out, and there was this little 12-year-old black boy who got an erection, and the doctor walks by and grabs his penis and laughed about it, you know.
Mm.
But he traumatized the boy. And when he came back 10 minutes later with the hypodermic needle, the boy became afraid and he started trying to get away. And then the doctor started slapping him in the face and around the head and yelling at him. And right now I'm getting scared just thinking about that event, because it scared me, because I had never been locked up before, never been away from home,
and I consider all of you all, like I said earlier, survivors, and I just wonder, you know, where do you go to when you're that young, to have the strength to even endure what you went through? I mean, you know, most kids at the ages that we're talking about don't really have a strong, you know, religious connection unless they were brought up in the church from the time that they were born. So where do you think, even for that short period of time, seeing the things that you saw, where did you find your strength?
Well, you know what? I have to say one good thing that happened to me at the school was that was one of the first times in my life that I reached out to Jesus. I know Johnny Gaddy too, Pastor Gaddy, told me that about himself, that he reached out to Jesus while he was there. And
you're a deacon, right?
Yes, I'm a deacon in my church.
But that was your first experience.
Well, I had gone to church. My dad took us to church, like on Easter and stuff like that. My parents took me on Easter, Christmas and stuff like that. But another advantage I had was I was 16 and a half years old. You can imagine, 16 and a half, you can kind of start figuring things out, you know, how to play the game, but just think how a 10-year-old is going to react to all that kind of stuff. And I've heard that the younger boys got more beatings than the older boys.
Hmm. And I understand that you guys had to dress. I think Mr. Gaddy said it in another interview. You guys had to wake up to the bugle, make your bed. I don't know what else it was that you all had to do, all within 5 minutes. Was it make your bed? Get yourself dressed, get in formation all within 5 minutes?
Well, I don't remember it being that quick. But then again, it was segregated when I was there, and I was the generation where they started to integrate. And about 67, they started integrating it. But I am absolutely sure the black guys had it, the black kids had it much worse than the white kids.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you know, I agree with you. I can't prove it, but I agree with you. Okay, listen, again, if you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, did the state of Florida allow rapes, torture, and murder at Dozier Reform School? We're talking to author Antoinette Harrell, survivors Johnny Lee Gaddy, Roger Dean Kaiser, Andrew Fuel, and Johnny Marks. Again, if you have a question or a comment, get on the phone lines now. We're going to talk to Chaplain Johnny Marks, and then we're going to take some phone calls. But we want to know what Chaplain Marks saw when he was at Dozier. Good evening, Chaplain. How are you?
Good evening. Quite well. Thank you. I'm enjoying your program, and I want to thank you and thank your staff for reaching out to us and reaching out to your audience and exposing some of these things that are very terrible, as you hear. So let me see. The question was, well, what was my experience? I'll share a little because I know you have a busy program. But I started off in Chobe School for Boys, so I was there twice. And then...
Wait, you there?
I didn't understand what you said.
What
Could you say it again?
What years were
okay.
you there?
59, and starting off in 1959 in Okeechobee. Okeechobee was a school that was basically established by the staff and the students from Mariana. So they took the biggest boys from Mariana, and they opened the school in Okeechobee. So that was my first time in Okeechobee, starting off as a kind of a young, small fella and getting a bad report from the judge. I was put in one of the cottages with the big boys, and I was the smallest boy in the cottage. So that was a little bit of a rough start, to say the least. So I was there for, I wasn't there very long, and I tried to escape, and I received the beating there, as you would in Mariana. Almost the exact same description as the other fellows described what went on, except there wasn't a White House. It went on in the library. So it was, school was connected, so some of my friends could hear the beating as it was being applied or ministered to me. And the one fellow said he lost count past 80.
Oh my.
So, and I was just a scrawny little guy. And I have to be honest with you, I did not know what was going on. You know, I just wasn't very aware, very savvy at the time. And like some of the other boys, I was just sent there for misbehaving and not attending school and misbehaving in school. So my first time, that's what it amounted to as far as the reason I was sent there. So so I was out in about, I think, 11 months maybe. I'm not really sure. My recollection on the dates and are not quite as good as the other fellows. I really appreciate them being there tonight. I mean, those are friends of mine, and I appreciate the work. I know Roger, one of the first fellows that I met when the guys started getting together, and the time and effort that he's put into all this, he's just put his life into it, you know, and you could hear that as he shares. So I just appreciate that so much. So, you know, so I was out of there and wasn't out very long, and I was back in after just a very short time. So then I, well, even though I got beat severely that first time, this time I escaped from there, and I ended up in Philadelphia. So I'm about 14 maybe, and I was there for a while. Someone took me in, and it's kind of a long story. I won't go into that, but then I ended up getting a job, lived in the downtown area of Philly, ended up working for the Globe Window Cleaning Company, and
also you were completely out of the state of Florida.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally escaped.
Did you ever return?
So, well, what happened, the fella that I worked with, the supervisor, he decided he needed more money. So we started robbing people and breaking and entering, and I kind of got into that. And so we were breaking into a place in New Jersey. And being from small town Sarasota, I just didn't realize things were different in the big city. So we went through a window, and when I got in there, there was a night watchman. So I ducked down behind this bar, and we pulled the bars off the window, and we came in through the cloakroom. So I thought, well, if I can make it to that door, you know, maybe I could lock the door and get out. So I ran for the door, and I turned around. And when I turned around to lock the door, he fired both barrels of a double-barrel 12-gauge shotgun. So I was covered from my stomach, both arms up to my chin, down below my belt. So I was in severe pain, so I kind of passed out for a while. And then I woke up, and the night watchman was a very elderly person. He had the shotgun in my face. And I just share this to say, you know, where you can be at a time like this, I mean, in your thinking and your emotional makeup. He put the gun in my face and said if I didn't tell where my friend was that he would blow my head off. So I just earnestly looked him in the face and said, well, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Oh.
So it was kind of a blur after that, and they took me to a county prison in New Jersey, and I was there for a while, and that's another kind of a whole story. And the state of Florida flew up to get me. They flew someone there to return me to the school of Okeechobee.
Wow.
So
of course, it must have been really bad when they got you back.
Well, surprising to me, they did not beat me when they got me back. They started my time over, I guess because I've been gone for a while and I suffered, you know, pretty severely from the gunshot wound. So, but I wasn't there too long and I escaped again. And I got away again. So, but this time I just went to my hometown of Fort Myers, and I stole a car close to Okeechobee. So that's the car I drove to my hometown, and I painted it with a paintbrush and put a tag, a stolen tag on it. And I just went to the sock hop and had a good time. And but after a while, I got bored with it, so I just drove back on campus to Okeechobee.
No, you turned yourself back in?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so then they decided, they still didn't beat me. They decided to not keep me. So they took me to the county jail in Okeechobee, the town of Okeechobee. So then they had a trial for me, which I didn't participate in, but they told me they had a trial for me. So then I was sent to Mariana from Okeechobee School.
Wow.
So, and when I arrived at Mariana, I was put in lockup, where they were speaking
now,
of.
Now describe lockup for those who don't know what lockup means.
Yeah, that was at the Pierce Hall Cottage, where the doctor was that they described earlier. Andrew was describing that doctor. So the lockup was very small, very my memory's not good on that. I have, I don't know, maybe it's kind of a gift. I have the ability to block things out that happen. That's very terrible to me. And so I don't remember too much of that, but I remember a guy named, a big fellow named David Walters. I think he was a superintendent at the time. And he came in, and he got right in my face, And he said, when they sent you here from Okeechobee, they wouldn't allow me to beat you. But he said, I'm going to get you. Before you get out of here, I will get you. And I knew that this man's going to kill me. If he gets opportunity, this man is going to kill me. So I was quiet. I stayed to myself. I became a barber. I became head barber. So I cut staff haircuts and got a little, you know, 50 cents here and there. But he did try to hold to that promise. One day he comes into barber shop and I'm there by myself, and he sits me in the chair and he gets the clippers and he starts just gapping my hair to try to get me to respond, where he could take me to the White House, which was right across the street. But of course I didn't bite because I knew what he was going to do. And he did almost get me right before I was going to go home. We had a banquet for the higher achievers, and we also had a little riot, a food fight. And, of course, he walks in, and even though I'm a higher rank, he looks at me and says, well, I know you were in on it. So he stands me up in line to go to the White House. But I had a praying grandfather. You know, so,
and I understand your brother went there as well. Is that correct?
My brother went there as well, and just like what you'll hear from the other men, and you've probably heard before, we never talked about it. My brother picked me up to bring me home from Mariana, and we never spoke a word about what happened to either one of us in Mariana. So I guess, you know, that it's just that devastating, you know. I mean, in a sense, it's really hard to explain. You know, these guys do a much better job than I do, but it is hard to
no one ever
explain.
Got counseling. I understand no one ever got counseling. I think Reverend Gaddy mentioned to me in the pre-interview that you went to a psychologist, but he gave you a bowl of soup. Is that right? Is that what you said, Pastor Gaddy?
Yes, ma'am.
A bowl of soup.
Mm-hmm. So I went to I was a regular at this fellow, same fellow, the doctor. And what he did to me is that he hooked wires all over me. And he, to my head and my body. And then he played some music, but he said to me that the message or what he was putting into my head, that I would not be able to distinguish or hear that. It was above my hearing. So then I did that on a regular basis, and I took the soup, the Sousa soup, they called it. So, yeah, I was under regular treatment there. And that was recorded. I think it was Roger maybe, that told me he saw that identified in Tallahassee in a statement. So they recorded that happening to me. So, but eventually I got out, and my brother came to get me.
You changed your life, and you eventually became a pastor, I understand.
Yes, that was later on in life. I was troubled for quite a while.
And it seems to be a pattern among a lot of you all that you got into trouble after that, drinking and womanizing.
Absolutely.
And addictions because of, I guess, trying to cope with what you had been through.
Exactly, yeah. The abuse that we suffered. And, you know, it's what's very similar with most of the men is the abuse. The family, the broken homes, mostly alcoholic parents at that time. You didn't have so much dope as you do now. But, you know, most of the guys came from that type of situation. And
you know what? Later in the show, we're going to have Pastor Marks to read us or have his wife read a poem that he wrote about the situation is very telling. I mean, very, very telling. If you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the topic, did the state of Florida allow rapes, torture, and murder at Dozier Reform School? We're talking to author Antoinette Harrell, survivors Johnny Lee Gaddy, Roger Dean Kaiser, Andrew Puhl, and Johnny Marks. If you have a question or a comment, get on the phone lines now. I'm about to take calls at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. Again, if you have a question or a comment, get on the phone lines now and call us up at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. Or if you're a survivor, you know, we'd like to hear from you. Call in tonight. Tell us a little of your story if time permits. We'd love to hear it. We're going to go to area code 941-356. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Good evening.
Good evening. Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. How are you?
I'm fine. I am Frank Marks' widow, Johnny Marks' sister-in-law.
Okay, yes.
And to kind of reiterate what Johnny was saying, you know, I was married to Frank for almost 30 years, and Johnny and Frank never discussed Dozier, ever.
Really?
Not until we went to the very first meeting with Roger in Brunswick did they ever discuss being in Dozier and the torture that went on there. Is really kind of strange. In over 30 years that I was married to him, he had told me about it, but picnics or get-togethers or dinners or holidays, never ever discussed it, not one time.
Did he exhibit signs of someone who had been through a traumatic experience, like, as they say, PTSD?
My husband?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, oh boy, did he ever. He was very hard to live with. The average, I don't know if anybody said this before, the average White House boy has been married 4 times. 4 is just about their number. They're very mentally, very emotionally, and very physically cruel. They're very angry. They're quick to anger. They don't sleep well. They wake up in the middle of the night terrified. I remember Frank telling our 4 boys numerous occasions when they would step out of line or get in a little bit of trouble or something, I'll kill you myself before I see you end up in Dozier. He had an absolute horrible fear that they would end up in Dozier. It just absolutely terrified him. And he would tell him, I'll kill you myself before they ever take you to Dozier. And so they suffered quite a bit as well, more emotional than physical. And I remember when we got Roger's book, he had me buy a copy for all the kids, all 5 of the kids, and he had me write in it because Frank couldn't read or write. He had me write in it, please read this. Even though it's graphic, it tells the true story of what went on, and maybe you'll understand why I was as tough on you as I was growing up. And it caused a great healing between him and the children because they were estranged for many years. And we lost Frank 4 years ago to cancer. But so he didn't get to see justice. And I just hope that the rest of my brothers live long enough to see justice from the state of Florida for what they did to these children, because it is just, it's horrifying, absolutely horrifying. I'm close personal friends with most of them, love them like family. I used to have a job where I worked from 6 p.m. at night to 6 a.m. in the morning, and they knew they could call me because I was the only one that was awake when the monsters came out at night. And I have shared stories with these men for years and years. And I can tell you, they lived through hell, and they live in hell. And the poem that Johnny wrote is phenomenal. I'm married to a pastor now as well. And it's a life-changing experience, But just what these men have suffered, you know, Frank would curl up in a fetal position, and my husband was one of the meanest, toughest men you ever met in your life. You'd never, ever, ever dreamed that he would curl up in a fetal position and whimper in his sleep when the nightmares come back, and I would very carefully wake him up and turn a light on in the room or something, because they always came and got these guys in the dark, and they waited for that steel hand to grip them in the dark. You know, they went to bed every night never knowing if tonight was going to be the night that they were going to be beat or murdered or raped or whatever was going to happen. They didn't have one single solitary night that these young men and children went to bed thinking, well, you know, tomorrow's going to be another day. Not one night. They lived in terror, went to sleep in total fear every single solitary night. And it you know, rolled over into their adulthood. The sound of just the floor creaking from the change of temperatures would wake Frank up out of a dead sleep, and he'd be straight up, and he'd have this look of terror in his face. And, you know, and I know that Roger and Johnny and all of these guys suffer this same horrific, horrific night terrors and night tremors and night sweats. It's horrible. It's a horrible way to live. And
let me ask you this before we move. How freeing was it for him to reunite with other survivors and be able to talk about it?
I might tell you what. The moment we walked in that room in Brunswick when Roger had the first meeting, his whole demeanor changed. He was an entirely different man the last 7 years that he lived, entirely different. And I said to him one time, what in the world? I wish I would have known the magic word to say to you 30 years ago to turn you around and give you the peace that this has given you. And he said, you walk in a room and you know that everybody in there knows you're not a liar. Mm. Everybody knows you're not a liar. And that was, like Johnny said, and Roger, and nobody believed you, nobody listened, and Pastor Gaddy said the same thing, because Frank came home and told his mother, and she said, oh, Frank, they didn't do stuff like that. You know, you're just making all that up. Nobody believed these guys, nobody. And to walk into a room and finally realize that you're not a liar, you're not crazy, that it really did happen, you didn't exaggerate, you didn't make it up, was just, it was like the weight was lifted off of his shoulders for all of these years that he had this horrible, horrible memories and secrets that nobody believed.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and telling Frank's story tonight. You know, I'd heard about Frank. Someone told me that Frank had been very angry for many years, and that toward the end of his life, if I'm getting the right person, that he apologized to everyone that he had wronged, even his enemies.
Absolutely, and all of his ex-wives.
And all of his ex-wives.
He went.
What a beautiful.
All the ones that were. I hear you giggling, Johnny.
you hear me.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Yeah. We're going to go to area code 256-659. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Good evening, and hello to everybody. This is Glenn speaking.
Hi,
now, all the brothers there pretty much know me. I went to Mariano Arthur G. Dozier back in 1980. I'm one of the people who came forward speaking about the atrocities that took place after the 1960s. And my cousin was also there, and so was my older brother. A lot of people believe that this only happened during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and, you know, earlier dated than that, but that's not true. In fact, as far as I know, the beatings were still occurring in the 80s,
wow.
Later 80s.
Did you experience any of that?
Me personally, yes, I did.
Yeah.
I went to the White House twice. It was supposed to have been closed down. But the building's still there. Tidwell was still there. In fact, I spoke with the FDLE about it because I was one of the children just before Tidwell left that could actually have him prosecuted. But unfortunately, the state of Florida at the time had the laws that if a child is over the age of 12 years old and it's been longer than 10 years, then statute of limitations runs out.
Okay, repeat that again, because this is going to be very crucial to the pending
litigation. For the statute of limitations.
Okay.
Anybody over the age of 12 years old, they couldn't be prosecuted against. Under the age of 12, I'm sorry. Anybody that's 12 and under, they can attack, but anybody that's over 12, they couldn't. Meaning, I went in at 13 years old, and because more than 10 years or 15 years had transpired, they said that they can't press charges, and the FDLE did a very large investigation about it, and I've been to a couple of the reunions with the fellas. I'm sure they know who I am. But what I'm concerned about now, if Roger could answer this for me, is are they going to try to find out how long ago the children died.
Mm.
That would be very important.
Roger Kaiser, can you address that?
Yeah, from what I gather, they're doing that now through the DNA. They're trying to, they can tell by whatever's left, and I'm not sure how much is left. They should be able to distinguish the race of the individual, various things like that. Now, I think things are going to break open. There's one thing that happened today that I think is very important, and that is, there's an article that came out in the New Yorker magazine from the professor of law at Columbia University, and he says that Tidwell should be prosecuted, that the state is not doing its job, that the state attorney should have immediately, when they said there were 31 graves out there and they found 55 bodies, he should immediately impaneled a grand jury to start a new investigation. So I think that's going to hold some weight. And so I think if that happens, I think all the information is going to come out.
Well, that would be a blessing, that's for sure. The thing that I'm concerned about is, I know it's been since 1980 since I was there, and there was two boys that I personally went into the White House with I never saw again.
Mm.
And
can we tell everybody who Tidwell is?
Tidwell is an individual who is a one-armed man who beat the living hell out of any child that he seen fit.
What was his title? Did you take me to
title? The only thing we ever called him was Tidwell, Mr. Tidwell.
Yeah, well, he was a home life supervisor.
When I tell you to stop doing something, but there were others that was there, like Mr. Robinson, and I don't know, my mind's kind of shot right now. But there were others in the cottages that were working that did likewise.
Mm-hmm. Really?
But it was a travesty that took place to all the children that were there. And mm-hmm. what a lot of people are failing to forget is that people were making money off of us as children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was
I'm not talking about just a few dollars. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of a year, millions, mm-hmm. for free labor.
And
not only that, judges were getting kickbacks too.
What type of things were they producing there?
It wasn't manual labor. That's basically what they were producing.
About,
like we had to work the fields and go to the graveyards and clean the graveyards up in the city and the towns.
Okay. And then weren't there cows and stuff like that on the farm? Wasn't it meat being produced there?
Not when I was there. There was only growing like corn, beans, and stuff like that.
Okay. But I saw pictures
I know
of animals. I think the people who were there in the 40s and the 50s, wasn't there meat and stuff being produced there?
We raised cows, hogs, chickens.
Yeah.
Syrup, peas, corn, peanuts, everything.
It was pretty self-sustaining, that's for sure.
Exactly.
It was operated like a state prison system, like it was back then. Because 5 months, 6 months after I got out of Mariana, I ended up going to prison facing first-degree murder for killing somebody who was very similar to Mr. Tidwell, who was raping one of my friends in front of me. And I was the very first youngest child ever to face the death sentence at age 14 in Florida.
Whoa. And were you convicted or?
I was convicted as an adult and sent to adult prison at 14 in 1982.
And how long were you there?
In prison? I stayed in there until I was 40 years old.
Wow.
I got out 6.5 years ago.
Y'all, that just shows you how deep this thing ran in terms of the abuse and what it did to the people that were you know, in there. I mean, the story just never ends. Thank you so much, caller, for calling
sure.
in tonight. Glenn,
I thank you again
show.
For... Great job, man.
Thank you. Pastor Gatti, Mr. Kaiser, Mr. Puhl, Mr. Marks, you know, you all story is just so incredible. Do you all even think today that counseling is something that each person who went through Dozier deserves? Do you think the state of Florida should be providing mental health counseling? It doesn't mean that you're crazy, or anything. I just think sometimes you need somebody to talk this thing through with. Does everybody think that the Florida should provide you that?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable request for sure.
Yeah. I just can't see how this is normal. I mean, I don't think that anybody should live through something like what you all live through and be left to deal with it on your own. I just can't imagine that. And so what Mr. Frank's wife said is true. The average survivor has had at least 3 or 4 marriages.
Yeah, that's true. This is my 6th marriage, and I've never been one to ever abuse my wives or anything. They just all told me that I was the most unemotional bastard they had ever met. One thing I will add, when this school should have known something was wrong all these years, the statistics show that in 1988, the recidivism rate of the boys returning to the school or going to prison was 98%. Somebody should have known right there something was wrong.
98%, that's pretty high. So
yes.
When you all look at the situation for what it was, do you all consider that the state of Florida at least has to take part responsibility for what happened to you all?
Well, I think there's no doubt about that whatsoever. I mean, if nothing else, I realize when you become a man, you're responsible for what you do. But Florida, a lot of the men going to prison or having the empathy totally beat out of them, I think Florida has to accept some of the responsibility of having planted that seed.
I heard someone earlier say something about an apology. Is an apology enough? If the state of Florida says to the survivors, I like in the families of those deceased, you know, we want to give you our deepest apology and, you know, have a great life, is that enough?
I don't think it's enough for me, and it's not just about getting anything out of the state of Florida. The thing is number one, an apology doesn't take back all the years that these men lost. I think that they deserve a little more than that. In fact, personally, I feel that they should compensate these men for what they lost in their lives. Nothing is ever going to take away the pain of what they did. So even if Florida was going to apologize, I don't know how much an apology would mean right now, though it certainly do, after calling everybody, all these men, liars for years, that they were just a bunch of old soldiers who can't get their war story straight. An apology maybe at first might have meant something, but now it's going to mean very little to me, but I still would like an apology from them, and I think the other men would too.
Antoinette Harrell, you've spent some time around these men. What do you feel when you've been around them? Are they people that are surviving broken, or do you feel like they picked up their lives and just gone on?
To say the least, they are, first of all, they are a lot of beautiful people, but you can tell that they are broken and they are trying to cope with the pain that they carry every day of their lives. Daddy, after 50 years, most of these men have been carrying his pain around for 50, 60 years. And I have to agree with Roger that an apology would not correct the pain that they have suffered. I mean, I've been around these men, both black and white, and they cry, you know, and no one can make up something like that. These men live through a living hell, and they are the real survivors. They're the heroes. And their wives are the sheroes to be able to deal with these men on an everyday basis, to feel their pain, to understand them, to hold them, to be there for them when no one else understands what they went through or what these nightmares are all about. Listening to them talk about the beatings and trying to seek justice, not only for the boys that was murdered and died there, but for those that are yet living. So Florida owe these men a lot.
Pastor Gaddy, you told a story to me in the pre-interview about when you ran away during the time that you were there, that when the dogs chased you down, what would happen once they caught you? Tell us about that story.
No, I didn't ever run away. I say the boys that did.
No, I'm saying the boys, whoever ran away. That's what I'm saying, the boys that ran away.
I wouldn't even know what direction to run in if I was to left. They would have to suck the dog
private part.
Yes.
Wow. And that was for what reason?
To reward the dog for catching them.
Wow. That is crazy, people. That's insane stuff. So, needless to say, there were some very sick people on staff at Dozier.
It
was some sick people out of Dozier, too. I thought the whole world was sick because then nobody would take our story to be true. So they look at us like myself, I had committed a big crime, just not going to school. So I kind of isolated myself through drugs and alcohol. I didn't go back to prison or anything, but I went to the drug and to the alcohol. But I met my wife, which we've been together 47 years, and I know I put her life through a living hell, but she stuck there with me.
Wow. Is it a situation in which, you know, after having gone through what you all went through, and by today's standards, you know, I think they probably say you had PTSD, but, you know, isn't that your behavior, you knew better, but you didn't know how to fix what you were going through, so your anger was directed at the people closest to you?
I will say so, because, but my anger didn't strike out on other people. My anger more or less was taken out on myself. Everything that I'd done bad wasn't to other people, it was to myself.
AJ, Christopher, any questions for our panel? I guess I've lost AJ and Christopher.
I'm just enthralled in the story. I think it's truly amazing, I guess, the overall conviction of the human spirit, because a lot of times we think the little trials we go through is all we can bear. But when it gets as bad as they had it and you still persevere, that means that he would never give you more than you can bear. We just don't know what that barren part is until we actually go through it.
Christopher.
Well, as I just sitting here listening, I mean, it's, you know, my heart and as much as I can understand goes out to everyone. The only thing that, I mean, I wanted to ask is, I mean, during the time that you gentlemen were there, what actually determined, I guess, when they would consider either sending you back home to your families, or was there any consideration, or basically when you had to, or when you were ordered to go there, there was no specified time? Did they just... So, and in the research, I really couldn't find where when they would sentence someone to go there, how long they said that you would be there, you know, on an individual basis. Do you know how they determine that?
Well, if I might comment on this, Pastor Mark's here. As I remember, you were not sentenced. You were committed. So, and my judge told me, Judge Elmer Friday, that I was no longer a citizen of the United States, that I was committed totally to the program. That was the first one at Okeechobee. So, and the only way you could get through that program was through a grade system. So if you misbehave or other things that could knock your grades back down, where you might start all over again, or if you went past that, you would have to go to the White House or the library and get it paddled, or yep, what they called paddled off, and then you'd still start at zero again. So, or if you were a runaway, you would start at zero again, and you'd have to work your way up to at least, I think Pioneer was one of the grades that made you a high enough rank to go home. So that if you went through that system, you would probably be maybe 8 or 9 months if you were, had a good record and go through that system, work your way through the grade system.
You know, Mr. Tidwell, the one-armed man that put so many beatings on so many young boys that came through Dozier, is still alive today, y'all. He's 87 years old. And to the victims that are on the lines tonight, what would y'all say to Mr. Tidwell if you got your moment in court? Let's just say he gets convicted of something, which I believe there's always going to be a fall guy, and it's probably going to be him. So if he gets convicted and you have that, what do they call those moments at the end of a trial when the victims get a chance to address the person? What would you all say to him today? Are there any words?
I would say, this is Andrew. Do you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I would tell him the Bible says he who covers his sins will not prosper. I think it would be the greatest blessing in his life if he would confess what he did, because at least he'd have a chance to go to heaven if he confesses. But he keeps covering up. You know, they had a hearing where they took the White House boys took him to court, and basically he just sat up there and lied. And he needs for his own soul to confess what he did. And we actually have an audio recording of him killing a boy.
Wow.
And a transcript, and the FDLE knows about that. The Justice Department knows about that. The FBI knows about that. So I would tell him to confess.
So is the state, let me understand you all to say, so are you all saying the state of Florida says that 400 victims are lying and Mr. Tidwell is telling the truth?
That's what they say.
Yep.
That's about it.
That's crazy. I mean, that's just re-victimizing the victim or victims to say that. That's incredible. I think I told Babs Cooper is someone I'd like to thank for helping me put together this show. Antoinette Harrell brought it to me, and Babs Cooper was very instrumental in helping put together all these people that are on the panel tonight. Other than Antoinette and Mr. Gaddy. And we talked about Mr. Tidwell. And one thing she said, you know, she doesn't understand why he's still alive and some other things. And I said, I really think he's still alive because sometimes your prison isn't where we may consider prison to be. His prison may be worrying if he's going to prison. Can you imagine being 87 and all of this is coming out? And your name keeps coming up every time somebody talks about what they went through. Can you imagine the prison that he must be in at 87, wondering what his fate will be for tomorrow?
I remember one story that I got from somebody in Mariana, and that was Mr. when this first broke. I guess probably a year after broke, Tidwell was in one of the supermarkets, and there were three young kids in there, about 9, 10 years old. And they said, pointed at him and said, "Hey, there's that woman or man that killed all them boys." He immediately left the store, and as far as I know, never came back. So that's what he's going to have to live with. And not only is he going to have to live with that, and Florida's going to have to live with it, we have made sure that we have put as many documents, as many books, as many items and information that we've searched out into every archive that we could possibly put it into. So this is going to haunt Tidwell for 100 years when the people start going on to the internet and looking up Troy Tidwell, it's all going to come up. When they look up Patton, it's all going to come up. When they look up Dozier, it's all going to come up. When they look up Florida, it's all going to come up.
I think this story, in my opinion, Mr. Tidwell is the George Zimmerman of this story. That's just how I see Mr. Tidwell. I really see it that way. We're going to go to phone lines again. We're going to pick up 941-567. I'm not sure if I had the number already. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Yes, good evening. This is Terry Barnes. How's everybody doing tonight? And I'm a White House boy.
Well, good evening, Dozier.
I was in the school in 64, and I went there for skipping school. And I stayed there 9.5 months, and I went to the White House one time after I was there like 3 weeks for talking about running away. And I got beat bloody by Tidwell and Mr. White, and then got put in Pierce Cottage lockup for 28 days. I was there with 3 pieces of bread and a cup of water a day. I think everybody there knows me.
And so you were how old when you were there?
13 when I was sent there.
And it was just
for skipping school? For skipping school. And the whole 9 months I was there, I stayed in plumb fear. And when we would go take a shower, everybody had to be naked, and you could see all the boys that been to the White House. Every day you would see 2 or 3 different ones. They wanted you to see their butts, how they was bloody and beat, black and blue. They wanted you to stay in fear all the time. But they let my parents come up to see me. I guess it was probably 3 weeks, maybe a month after I got beat, and I was still black and blue. And I just got back to where I could walk pretty good and sat down. But my mom seen my butt, and my dad and mom got plumb mad about it, and my dad told me he was taking me out of the school, so he went to the administration building up there. I don't know who he talked to, but anyway, they called the Jackson County Sheriff Department out there, and they told him if he removed me from the school that they would put him in jail. So the next day after they left, Tidwell locked me up in lockup, and I stayed down there for, 28 days on 3 pieces of bread and a cup of water a day on a concrete slab with a little bucket to use the bathroom in. And they took away all my visiting rights, but what got me out of there as quick as it did after that was I think I was up to, Pioneer. No, I was like grub. They knocked me back down to a grub. But I left the school as a grub when I got out. And my parents had a good friend. It was a circuit judge in Tallahassee, Florida. That's where I got sent to the school from. Anyway, he helped get me out of there.
Can you tell us what a grub is for those of us that don't know what that term means?
That was the ranking thing they had in the school system. You started out, that was lowest you could get was a grub, and then you worked your way up to, I think it was like a grub, a rookie. Then you went on up to a pioneer, and then ace was the top thing. But I left out of there. When I got out 9 months after I was there, I went out of there as a grub, and that was the lowest thing you could have.
Wow.
Zero.
Well, let me ask you something. With so many angry boys locked up in one institution, what was that atmosphere like to have that many angry boys in one place? Was there a lot of violence among the inmates?
I was in Jefferson Cottage. I think the majority of them when I was there in that cottage was 13, 14, I think, was about the highest. They had like 500-something boys there in that school when I was there. And they kept you in such fear. If you seen a state car coming down the street, You just wanted to hide. Everybody would squat down and look the other way, hoping they wouldn't stop to get you.
This is crazy. I mean, I'm hearing these stories, and it's just, I guess because I cannot even wrap my mind around how the state of Florida allowed this. I mean, it's just, if the reputation was on the street, that means somebody went back and told the state of Florida how bad it was. How in the world was this allowed? It just blows my mind.
The state of Florida knew what was going on at school, but they was making so much money off of it that that's what it was all about to them. The more kids they could send to that school, the more money they would make.
I think that's exactly what it was. Pastor Gaddy, you told about letters. You told me in a pre-interview that they had you all write back home. Explain to us what those letters, what they told you to put in those letters that you wrote back home to your parents.
About how I was doing so well, doing good. But see, my mother didn't have much education because she was marking an X. So she, and I had guys to write my letter for me, but when I got home and I seen the letters, they was talking about how good I was, and I had made, see, up there you had 4 months in each rank from a, when you got there you was a rookie, you had to go 4 months, and you went to an explorer, you had to go 4 months, you had to go to pioneer and pilot and ace, each one was 4 months to come out of it. But like he was saying, grub was the lowest rank. And I tell my mama, I could never leave out the grub rank because I was always fighting. But my mama ain't getting out. She said she didn't get no letter like that. They just told her how good I was doing. And she said I had a beautiful handwriting. And I got a spanking today. And so my mother was on the impression, you got a spanking, that wasn't too bad.
This is just tear jerks and stuff. I'm just sorry. It breaks my heart. And I know you guys are so many years removed from this, but to hear you all tell your stories, it's as though it just happened yesterday. I mean, it's just wow, and I'm just amazed that.
Ma'am, I used to wake up when I got out of that school, and I used to have nightmares, and I would wake up crying. I cried so many times with the nightmare about those beatings that my pillow would be soaked, and I'd wake up hollering and crying. This went on for years. Matter of fact, I had a nightmare 2 weeks ago about this, and this is over 50 years that I've carried this with me. I've been to counseling with it, and the counselor told me that this caused me to have a mental block. And I try to deal with it. It's not as bad as it was years ago, but, and I thank the state of Florida. This is what I think personally. The state of Florida cannot take back what they done to me and all these men. This shouldn't have never happened. Apology ain't going to get it. Even if they was to give a man $1 million apiece, that's not going to take back what they've done. We talking 50 years of people's lives that this state has done to them.
I agree. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that these 55 bodies have been found. What does that mean for those of you all who are surviving? Is that pushing you all stories to the side, or are you all still feeling like the state of Florida, you know, is paying attention to you all story as well, or is it all about the 55 bodies right now, or 55 skeletal remains, I guess I should say? Roger Kaiser.
Yeah, well, I think Florida's planning, from what I hear, to try to make that the big ordeal so that if there is any civil liabilities to come out of this, that they figure they can get out of this a lot more cheap by dealing with 8, 10, or 12 families rather than having to deal with 300 or 400 men. And they think that they can get the general public to go along with them because the boys in these families who The families who have boys that were either killed or died of natural causes who were just thrown out there in the woods and buried, they're going to make it appear that that's a lot more important than their quote, a bunch of whiny little bastards who got a spanking. Well, if you would have been there, believe me, it was no spanking. It was actually the only thing I can even compare this to that I have ever seen was some of the movies I've seen where they flog people on ships. That's, to me, just about how bad it was. I mean, you were just pushed to the limit to where you just either passed out or you were killed. That's how bad it was, and that's how bloody it was.
So let me ask you all, what is going on right now? I'll address this to Antoinette, Harold, and anyone else on the panel, Kaiser Fuel, Marks, Gaddy. What do you all want people to do to help you right now? Because is there petitions in place? Do you all want them to write to Senator Bill Nelson? You want them to write to the governor? What do you want them to call the governor, call the senator? What do you all need for people to do, whether they're in Florida or out of Florida, to help you all with this cause?
I think they're
going
to
like boat with a
$100
One at a time. Do what?
I think they ought to write the governor of Florida, especially the Attorney General, Pam Bundy, who is somewhat sympathetic to our cause, and ask that, not to ask for anything specific, but just to ask that justice and the right thing be done.
Anybody else? What would you all like to see? Because, see, people are going to care. Trust me, people are going to care when they hear this story. What do you all want them to do? What do you all need people to do? Who do you want them to call? What do you want them to do? Is there a petition in place?
No. I want them to give me a boat with 150 horsepower where I can, I'm 67 now, I'm retired, and I can go ahead and fish because everything, I don't believe nothing's going to come out of it. They can go out there I keep telling them there's body all over that place. And they done let it grow it up, and trees done come on. They done build a look like a juvenile center on top of them bodies. Because where it was when we was working, we worked the whole place. So if I can get a boat and go fishing, I'll be satisfied.
Wow. So tell me this. You know, and one thing that stuck out, and I think it's the image of it on the boards that you're looking at. What was it like? There appears to be a church building on that campus. What kind of church were they having in a place like that? I mean, what kind of services were y'all having, and who was conducting them? Can anybody answer that? Does anybody remember church?
Yeah,
we had church service. We had good singing.
Preach? You mean there was actually preachers who came by there and ministered to you all?
Yes, ma'am. It was as you go in on the north side, they got the churches. The first thing you see when you come on the north side was the big church on the black side.
Yeah.
I am amazed. That blew me away. That was the one image that stuck out in the back of my mind. I saw a church building, and I thought,
yeah.
what kind of services were being conducted in the church building?
Well, this is
Andrew.
They were crucifying
us like they was doing Jesus.
Wow.
The only time I felt peace was when I was in church. Now, Roger has a whole different story about church because he can tell it, but I felt peace when I was in church, and we had this black preacher who was real charismatic, and I was raised in a Lutheran church, which is kind of conservative, kind of a church, but when I went there, it was kind of neat because it was kind of Pentecostal-like, and it was a completely different experience for me, but like I said, I think I found Jesus there. I think a lot of boys found Jesus in that situation in Mariana. They had a way of doing that.
Yeah, I went to church, but I went to church because you had to go to church. I remember you had to put on your white shirt and your tie, You had to have your shoes shine, your belt buckle shine. But to me, going to church, I was just as scared in church as I was anywhere else. You didn't open your mouth in church. You went to church and you were just as scared in church as you were in school or in the dining hall or walking down the sidewalk. You'd better not spark. You'd better not blink. You'd better not do whatever it is you wasn't supposed to do. They'd just soon knock the crap out of you in there and take you to the White House and drag you out as anywhere else. So I wouldn't trust the preacher. There was nobody you could go to. I don't care if you were a homesick little baby. There was nobody to go to, not even the preacher, that you can go and say, hey, I feel bad. I feel sorry. You better not feel sorry because you're going to get it. There was nobody you could trust. You couldn't go to anybody, not even the minister. So church meant very little to me back then.
And I can't believe that. I mean, I don't know. I just can't imagine that any preacher could come in and conduct a service in a place like that and God not lead them to know that something was wrong. I just find something odd about that.
They were, as far as I was concerned, they were just another employee. They went along with the program. There were several. There was a preacher, there was a priest, and whoever. You can't tell me that somebody that is truly a religious individual can go up there and see what is going on at that school and seeing boys beat to their bloody black and blue and green and yellow when they're asked, when they walk out of the White House, and a minister put up with that. They just went along with the program, with the job, and that was what it was for them.
To piggyback on what you just said, they were just another employee. Were there any good people that worked at that place? I mean, was everybody evil at Dozier, or was there anybody on the staff that tried to help the inmates out at all?
Well, there were some people who cared, but they didn't last very long. And if they didn't go along with the program, they didn't stay there very long. There were some that would try to protect their boys up to a certain degree, but they only did it by not writing you up if they caught you getting into a fight or if they caught you doing something you weren't supposed to do. They would protect you that way. But not one of those college fathers would go against Tidwell, Hatton, or Dozier. None of them.
You know, and basically, because we're running out of time, and I want all of you all to have closing remarks. Was there a stigma, or I think Mr. Gaddy explained it to me, there was a stigma attached to the fact that you were someone or you had been someone who had attended Dozier? Was that, or had been in Dozier? Was that how it was that people considered you like a bad seed if you had been to Dozier?
Well, that didn't affect me when I got out. In fact, I never heard anybody say anything like that because it wouldn't have mattered to me. I mean, Dozier, of course, it was the Florida School for Boys, the Industrial School for Boys, Mariana, when I was there. So being there was no different than the orphanage. So that was just a place I went. Nobody ever said anything. I never told anybody until I got older because I was afraid I'd go back. So nobody ever knew.
Pastor Gaddy, was it you that told me that people looked at you as a bad kid if you had been to Dozier?
Yes, ma'am. I lived in a loop area, mostly family and friends, and we lived in a little small town in Dade City out in the country area. So everybody knowed everybody. If you went someplace, they knowed you went, and that's what I received. I was a bad kid.
Well, since we got you on the mic right now, Pastor Gaddy, what is it that you want to leave with us about your experience at Dozier, or, you know, what you want people to do to help you all, or what you expect from the state of Florida? I think you already told us you want a boat, but what else would you like us to know in closing?
I would like for someone to just to purchase our books, you know, and read a little that we went through. And like Roger said tonight, it was back in my time, it wasn't integrated. It was black on one side, white on the other side. And I would love to see the guys come together as one, and, you know, and I hope the family get their family members back, the remaining of the family members.
I agree. I agree. Antoinette Harrell, you along with Pastor Gaddy wrote a book. What is the name of your book? Antoinette Harrell. For some reason, I don't know if we're having phone line problems with Antoinette Harrell, but Antoinette Harrell and Pastor Gaddy wrote the book Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rape, Murder, Beatings, and Slavery. And they both co-authored that. And as Pastor Gaddy said, go out and get that book and help them get the word out about what happened at Dozier. Roger Kaiser, closing remarks.
I guess if I had could have anything that I wanted from the state of Florida, number one, well, I'll put them in order.
Mm-hmm.
When all this is done, when all the families have been contacted, when the bodies that are not going to be recovered, when all that's done, I think Florida should pay for every one of the White House boys to go to the facility. I think it should be open. They should have a big deal out there. I think the governor should come and all of his cabinet, and I think they should put us all out there, and they should feed us, and they should give us Coca-Colas, and I think they need to apologize with the whole world, with every camera that you could possibly get in there, and then I think we need to go over, if they're going to rebury those boys, the remains of those boys, I think there better be one hell of a big monument up there with something really heartfelt, and that they will agree to keep that up. And then I think they need to compensate the men. And if they do that, I would be satisfied. It's never going to take away the unhappiness that I felt as a child. It's not going to take away the unhappiness I feel today as an adult. But at least I'll feel that I got something out of it.
What do you think they should do with those grounds? Do you think they should not? They should remind be like a memorial or something? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think they would. I don't think they would ever do that. I really don't. Personally, I really don't care what they do with it. I after I go back there the last time, if they do what I think they should do, that'll probably be the last time I would ever go there anyway. The only thing that I think should be, if I had my way about it, what I think should be done is I think the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America should go out there and buy that property, or the state ought to give it to them to have their jamboree, and they got a swimming pool, and they got a gymnasium, and they got all them places. They could have one hell of a jamboree for all the Boy and Girl Scouts and turn that place into something positive to do something decent for kids, and then I think the state ought to help support it.
That's a beautiful thought. That's a beautiful thought. Andrew Puhl, closing remarks.
Yes, if your listeners live in Florida and they would contact their representative or their state senator and just
mm-hmm.
tell them that they believe that the White House boys should be compensated financially for what they suffered, and that would be a wonderful thing if people would do that, because it has to be done in a claims bill, and if it's not done by March, then it'll be 2015 before it can come up again in the state legislature. So, and that'll be another year. And so many of our guys have already died. We've had one case I can think of where one of the White House boys has committed suicide.
Wow.
And so we're old men. You know, we're dying off, and I hope Florida's not using that as a strategy. You know, the longer we wait, more of them die, and the less we have to spend, but it'd be pretty cold-hearted if that's the way they're thinking.
Well, Mr. Puhl, you don't want to just say, I want to help correct you here, you're not just saying you want help from the people in Florida, because anybody can write your representatives, right?
Well, yeah, but I think it would be, if somebody's living in Florida, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I any help we can get from anybody, anywhere.
Okay.
We would just appreciate it.
Okay, just wanted to clarify that. Chaplain Johnny Marks, I heard about a poem that you wrote, and Mrs. shared it with me, and I found it to be so beautiful. Is there any way that you can share that with us tonight before we close out?
Yes, I'm going to have my wife share it. I don't think I've ever been able to get through it, so
okay.
I'm going to let her share. And I want to encourage us, the guys, you know, to keep reaching out in the legal system. You know, I'm not gifted at that, you know, being able to do that like they do, but they put so much work into it. You know, but I read that 80% of the men in prison, men and women in prison, are of gifted abilities. And I know each guy that I meet, he has, whether he believes it or not, he has a gift that's special to him, as you do. And you're able to share this program and reach out. You are doing the work to touch the people and change lives. So I want to encourage each person and their family to reach out with the gift that God has instilled in them and share with the next person. We share every year for several years at the University of South Florida, and these young people that are studying criminal justice and juvenile justice, these young people, they respond so tremendously. They write us letters and emails, and they are so encouraged when they hear the testimony, and they want to do something about it. You know, they want to change things. They want to change the abuse and that we hear that's happening today, and the abuse that happened to us. It's in many different forms today, you know, we hear about. So I just want to encourage everyone to continue to reach out and use the gift that God has them, has put in their life, and it's unique to them. So I want to encourage them that way, and I'm going to give the phone over to my wife, and this prayer, or my wife calls it a poem, that was given to me. I'm not a writer. My wife is a writer. But it was given to me quickly, and I was able to share it at that first meeting in Georgia, and it touched many lives, as it still does. So I really appreciate what you're doing, and I want to encourage you to continue. And I hope to see you or talk to you once again. So here's Frances Marks, and she's going to share with you.
Thank you, Chaplain.
It's a three-part poem.
Okay.
Part one. When I first started getting into trouble, it was the same as it was for many boys, fighting and not going to school. Each time I was caught, I went in front of the judge. One day he got tired of seeing me, so he sent me to Florida School for Boys. This was in 1959 or 60. Because I was fighting so much, the judge thought it would be a good idea to put me in a cottage with boys who were all bigger than I was. I was 14 or 15 years old and didn't weigh very much. When I went to FSB, I was picked on a lot by the boys in my cottage, and no one fought fair. Now, when I first went to FSB in Okeechobee, I was taken to the office and shown the paddle, which was to be used on boys who misbehave or ran away. It was not really a paddle. It was a double leather strap, about 1 inch thick and about 4 inches wide and about 3 or 4 feet long. I was told how much it weighed, 16 ounces or more. Since I was from what was then small town Fort Myers and previous to that small town Sarasota, I had no idea how evil people could be, and I never dreamed what that weapon called a paddle could do to me. I was not there very long before I decided I would run away, not thinking of the consequences. When I was caught, I was immediately taken to the office to receive my punishment. I lay on the bed. Mr. Davis told me to face the wall and hold on to the pipe at the head of the bed. He said that if I let go, screamed, or moved, they would start the beating all over. I was so scared. I almost peed in my pants. The beating began. The pain was beyond description as a grown man used all his strength to drive that weapon into my backside. I could hear the belt. in terrified expectation as it was dragged across the floor, raised up, and then as I was hit, an explosion of pain. This continued for some time. The boys outside who could hear the strike stopped counting at 80 hits as the beating continued. Throughout the experience, in my mind, I cried out, "Oh, God, what is happening to me? Please, God, help me. I'm just a little boy who ran away. This can't be happening to me. Please help." 10, 11, 12, 13, 80, and more. Part 2. Broken dreams, broken wives, broken kids, broken lives. We're going down. Hold the bed. Don't let go. It starts all over again. Now the wives and the kids are going down. Dad, please make it stop. Part 3. For me, it didn't begin to stop until I was about 30. At that time, a person I was living with gave me a book to read. I started reading about a man who was wrongly accused. When he came before the judge asked him if he did the things wrong that people said he did. The man would not answer. The judge said, "Don't you know that I have the power to sentence you to life or death?" The man would not defend himself. As I read, I could see that this man was going down. The soldiers put thorns on his head. They beat him beyond recognition. He didn't let go. They beat him more. He still didn't let go. He held on for you and for me. With each hit, he felt all our pain, all our sickness, all our disappointments, our anger, our shame, all our loneliness. Then they put him on a bed of wood called a cross. To make sure he didn't let go, they put nails through his hands and feet. He could have let go of that bed. He could have come down from that cross. He could have called his friends to help. He could have taken the bad guys out. But he didn't. He held the cross. His friends were gone. His followers were gone. He looked up and his father was gone. He didn't let go. For you and for me, he didn't let go. Now we can hold on. When life beats us up, when the pain is too much, we can hold on because he held on for all of us. Thank you, Jesus.
Wow. Y'all, that makes me tear up. I'm sorry. When I heard it the first time, it made me tear up. And it's making me tear up again. Again, y'all, in closing, I'd like to say thank you again to Antoinette Harrell, Johnny Gaddy, Andrew Huell, Chaplain Johnny Marks, and Roger Dean Kaiser for being my guest tonight. And listen, y'all go out and buy these books. Support these people. The Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rape, Murder, Beatings and Slavery by Antoinette Harrell and Pastor Johnny Lee Gaddy. The White House Boys and American Tragedy by Roger Kaiser. Also go out and get The Truth You Decide by Roger Kaiser and also, lastly, get the book The Misfit Investigators by Roger Kaiser and Andrew Huell. And again, we thank Pastor Marks for that poem, touching me all over again. A reminder, y'all, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. Also, listen, join us back here February 7th, 2014, from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern, as Lindsay Williams and Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez of BioCare from Tijuana, Mexico, is going to be our guest again, telling us about alternative medicine. Also a reminder, if you want to learn more about this story, we couldn't cover it all tonight, y'all. It's just too great. You can go to some of the websites, theofficialwhitehouseboys.org. That's theofficialwhitehouseboys.org. You can also go to thewhitehouseboysonline.com. That's thewhitehouseboysonline.com. And you can also go to thewhitehouseboys.com. That's thewhitehouseboys.com. Okay, y'all, we got to get out of here. But, again, what a great show. I really enjoyed hearing the stories. Some were more than I can even wrap my mind around, but I know God is able. But I'm going to ask everyone in the listening audience, pray for the White House boys. Y'all, this ain't easy, and they've carried this burden for way too long. Let's help them with our prayers and with our support. Let's write the representatives, the state governor. Let's write to the state senator, Bill Nelson, and anyone else that they mention that they feel that will help in getting this justice for this group of people. So, again, thank you guys for listening tonight, and I hope that you all will do what you can that's within your power to help them get justice. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You're good.